We're going to take a brief respite from the traditions and for a couple of three sessions address the question, what about Islam? A few weeks back, we've talked in world religions in years past just briefly some things about Islam and basic beliefs. But there is a lot of emphasis these days, has been for the last few years in particular, with folks who claim to be the voice of Islam, who claim to be followers of Islam, who claim that what they're doing is in the name of Allah and Islam. And so a few weeks ago, someone asked a question. We won't mention any names, but someone asked a question about Islam and said, could we maybe talk about it, especially given stuff that's going on, and do they really want world domination and all of these kinds of things? And so that's what we're going to attempt to do. So, when you think of Islam, what comes to mind? Muslim?
Moors.
The Moors? Elsewhere. Not the Scottish Moors, but yeah.
ISIS?
Mid-Eastern?
Arab.
Terror?
Ahab?
Ray Stevens? Well, you know, there are a lot of those things that come to mind in recent years. You've got ISIS, you've got Taliban, you've got Al-Qaeda, you've got all kinds of things. But when you start talking about Islam, one of the first things that comes to a lot of folks' minds is Allah. And then the question, is Allah the same God worshipped by Jews and Christians? According to Muslims, it is, because there's only one God. And Syrian Christians, actually, since they pray in Arabic, that's the word that they use when they pray to God, even though they're Christian. That's for them, that's the word, Arabic word for God, as in God the Father, for them. But other things that come to mind typically have to do with the founder of Islam, Muhammad. Muhammad, there are questions about when Muhammad was actually born, but somewhere in the late 500s to early 600s, we find his birth taking place. We have someone else wandering down the sidewalk, so we'll kind of slow down a moment. Want to make sure she doesn't fall down the steps. Jane Satterfield. No. No, and she's not wearing the hijab either, so.
That's a relief.
Should be coming up on the porch about now. But, yeah. We were waiting on you. No, I saw you coming down the sidewalk. I just want to make sure you didn't fall. But we think of all of these, and Muhammad comes to mind. Muhammad's father was named Abdullah, which means servant of Allah. His mother was named Amina, which means peaceful. And originally, Muhammad and Muhammad's clan were actually Bedouins. They were Bedouins of the Hashim clan, which was the largest and most powerful of all of the Arabic clans. They were part of a group known as the Quraysh, the largest, most powerful of all Arabic clans. Muhammad's people had settled in Mecca. In fact, his father worshipped at the Kaaba, which had already been built, the big building that you see them marching around, which is the most holy site in all of the world for Muslims, the Kaaba in Mecca, the cube, large cube, black cube building. They had settled in Mecca. They actually had a very successful caravan and livestock business, and they ran caravans regularly. His father died before Muhammad was born. His father's heritage was traced to Ishmael and then to Abraham. They were known as the Hashemites. That was their particular group within the tribe. His mother died when he was 6 years old. And according to, since there were no siblings, according to tradition, he was too young. According to Arabic tradition, he was too young to keep the estate, so he had to give up his father's estate. And he was sent to live with a foster family in one of the Bedouin tribes. But he didn't stay there very long. Eventually he went to live with his grandfather. And his grandfather, he went back to Mecca to live with his grandfather. When he was with the Bedouin tribe, he was wandering out. And he went back to Mecca to live with his grandfather. And his grandfather, with whom he lived, was the custodian of the Kaaba. And so he was the one who took care of it, and Muhammad grew up around that. And the Kaaba originally was very pantheistic. All kinds of gods and goddesses were worshipped at the Kaaba. All kinds of statues were there. All kinds of shrines to different gods and goddesses were present. After his grandfather died, Muhammad was sent to live with his uncle, Abu Talib, who ran a very, very, very successful caravan business. And Muhammad learns the business, and eventually Muhammad gets to where he leads caravans, major caravans to other parts of the world. He traveled extensively in Palestine, Syria, and the area around Yemen. And in Syria in particular, he encountered a large number of Jews and Christians, and they were living side by side very peaceably at that particular point in time, 7th century A.D.
Were vans their main mode of transportation?
Camels and horses with a caravan, that kind of thing.
You're talking about where he's living peaceful. Now, from what I understand earlier, or was it later than this, he got run out of some place.
Yeah, we're getting ready to get there.
This comes later.
Okay. This is his early life. While he was there in Syria on one of his extensive caravan trips, he ran into a Syrian Christian monk. And this Christian monk got to talking with him and came up to him, got to talking with him, and then told him that he was the unnamed non-Jewish prophet Shiloh from Genesis chapter 19. Interesting thing is, if you go look at Genesis chapter 19, you don't find an unnamed prophet in there whatsoever. You find the two unnamed messengers or angels. But Shiloh is not mentioned anywhere in that particular book. Not in the Hebrew text, because I've checked that out. Not in the Septuagint, the Greek version. I've checked that out. Shiloh is nowhere. What that monk probably was meaning was that he was one of those two messengers. And at this point in time, there were a lot of folks in Arabia who believed in a form of reincarnation. And so that would be something with which he would be familiar with, this pantheistic kind of encounter. Some think that at that particular point in time, that was the beginning of Muhammad's spiritual journey. But Muhammad did seem, and he talked about it later, and did seem impressed with the fact that here in this place, Jews and Christians were living peaceably together in Syria at that time, and they were worshiping the same God, one God. Even though the Christians talked about Jesus as Son of God, they were worshiping in unity one God. Very much unlike Arabia's polytheism and all the fights that went on between the different groups worshiping other gods and goddesses. So this began something of a mystical journey for Muhammad. He ran a caravan business even more, and when he was 25, he was hired by a very wealthy widow in Mecca. Which, you know, that was the holy site, that's where he was living. Her name was Khadijah. And she was so impressed with him, took a couple of journeys with him on these caravans, she was so impressed, she proposed to him, and he accepted. And they got married. He was 25, she was 40. She was a cougar. She was a cougar. They were married for 25 years. And they went on spiritual retreats together, very often, to Mount Hira. And once during Ramadan, while they were on a spiritual retreat at Mount Hira, Muhammad said he encountered the angel Gabriel, and this was in 610 A.D. He encountered the angel Gabriel, who spoke the words that are found in the Quran, in Surah 96. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, recite in the name of your Lord who created, created man from clots of blood. Recite, your Lord is the most bountiful one, who by the pen taught man what he did not know. Indeed, man transgresses in thinking himself his own master. For, excuse me, not 96, 95. Or is it 96? No, it is 96. Indeed, man transgresses in thinking himself his own master, for to you, Lord, all things return. And so he told him those words and had him recite those words and told him that he had been called to be a prophet of Allah. A prophet of Allah. And so at that time, he surrendered control of himself, and according to tradition, he spoke the words of Allah. By the way, in the pantheon of gods, that whole polytheistic, many gods in the pantheon of gods, Allah was the chief god, L-L-A-H. He was the chief god, the high god, among all the gods. I mean, if you were talking about Greek religion, it'd be Zeus. Roman religion, it'd be Jupiter. But here you're talking about within Arabic tradition at that time, Allah was the high God among many, many others. He didn't know what to do. He was confused by it, and so his wife called in her cousin, who was, and I've got her name here if you want to know, but who was a Christian, a Syrian Christian. She listened to all of this that was told by Muhammad and his wife. And she eventually told him that he was a prophet from the line of Moses. Prophet from the line of Moses. Now, eventually he started preaching. And his initial message was one of monotheism and unity and a religion called Islam, which means submission to Allah. Submission to Allah. He had contemplated the unity of the Jews and the Christians with that one God, and so this really impressed him. And so his initial message was monotheism, there is only one God, unity, and that was to be found in this religion that followed Allah. Initially, that was by oral tradition and recitations. By the way, Muhammad was illiterate. Muhammad could not read or write. Well, Muhammad was illiterate, could not read or write, and so he had to memorize things. And he said he was memorizing these things, and he had been told to recite them. By the way, Quran means the recitation. The recitation. After his death, the process of compiling the Quran began. Before his death, it was just passed along through oral tradition and memorization. There were people, and later on we'll talk a little bit about Quran, probably not tonight, probably some other time, but talk about Quran when it was compiled, and when they finally started compiling it, a fair amount of time after his death, different people went around to find places where anything had been written down, kind of like on a cocktail napkin, because it wasn't written, things were written on papyrus, on palm leaves, on pieces of leather, on shoulder blades of animals, you know, anywhere somebody heard him talking, started writing it down. Go ahead.
How do they get around creation? If he was born to 500 and something.
Well, but
how do they get?
Oh, he recited creation, yeah, and God.
He just heard it from somewhere.
Right, he supposedly heard it from the angel Gabriel when he was in one of those caves at Mount Hira on a spiritual retreat with his wife. So, and actually, if you listen to the teachings, well, if you read Quran and you listen to the teachings of a lot of the imams, regardless of whether Shia or Sunni, the belief is that the very first Muslim was Adam.
Yeah, don't they go up to Abraham as far as we're
coinciding? Coinciding with us, but then they go all the way back and say that Adam was actually the first Muslim, and Adam had a copy of the Quran. Well, you know, of course, this is not as nearly as old in written form as in, you know, what, as the Old Testament or as Christian scriptures. So, yeah. Do what?
How did he have a copy of it?
He was told by the angel Gabriel to recite what the angel told him, and so he memorized and recited over and over again what the angel told him.
Yeah.
The heart of his early message was, there is one God, you are to renounce all paganism and live according to Allah's laws. Now, he taught this to his people, that is his tribe, for 3 years. But more of his family turned into enemies of his and his message than converted. Very few of his family even believed him and converted. But then again, many of them are the keepers. His grandfather was the keeper of the Kaaba. That gets passed down to his grandfather's sons, the keeper of the Kaaba. And what did they do? They let all these other folks run through with all this pantheon of gods and goddesses, and they made money hand over fist from that, in addition to the caravans, etc. His family turned on him because of his pilgrimages as well. And in 619, his wife and his uncle both died. It's also at that same time that his wife and uncle died that Muhammad claimed to have been transported on a celestial journey at night while he was sleeping near the Kaaba. Gabriel took him to the temple site in Jerusalem, took him through the seven heavens, where he visited all the prophets before him, from Adam to Moses, on up to Jesus. Took him to the gates of hell to show him what the heretics would experience. And then to the very presence of God, who gave instructions on how Islamic worship was to be carried out and the daily prayers. So he starts telling his vision. And instead of gaining more converts in Mecca, he started gaining more enemies, even among his friends. In 621, in the midst of all of that chaos, and he never knew when people, I mean, there were people that would attack him in the streets. In the midst of all that, men from Medina asked him to come to Medina, to leave Mecca and come to Medina, because they had heard about his message that he was preaching. Medina's the second holy city. He went there, and many people converted from paganism in Medina to what he was teaching as Islam. Over time, as the converts increased, Muhammad began to spend more time overseeing governing than he did spiritual things. He had to do both, but he started spending more and more time with civil matters and governing. It's also during this time that he shifted, his message shifted. It shifted from peace and unity to conflict and war. Because he had been run off, you know, yes, the man from Medina offered him, he said, please come and teach us, but that was really an offer of sanctuary, because he was in trouble and chaos in Mecca. Even his family weren't accepting it. So he leaves, he was trying to preach peace and unity, they wouldn't be unified, men from Medina come, say, come to us, he goes over there, they start accepting, all that kind of stuff. But then as things grew and as more money was needed and more control was needed, his message shifted from peace and unity to conflict and wars.
What made it so right for them to accept him, whereas he was being beaten around and everything else? Why would they?
They were actually in Medina. They were getting tired of all the conflict between the different Bedouin tribes. And so what he set out to do, this was to be, and he was told by God that he was to be the leader of a religion that would cover the entire world and unify the world. So Islam sees its ultimate goal as conquering the whole world for Allah and having everyone worship Allah or the heretics. And so he began to align all these different Bedouin tribes around the ideas that which became classic Arabian strategy of war: conquer, force the people to submit, and loot all the stuff. Build up big budgets. You know, fill the coffers, those kinds of things. So after a while, he had aligned so many Bedouins with him that he started thinking, I got all this power. I got all these people. I got all this money. It's time for all those folks in Mecca who were mean to me to pay. And so he eventually decides to conquer Mecca and all of his tribesmen that had pushed him out before, to conquer the holy city and to force it to follow Allah, to get rid of all the other. But he needed funds to do that. So he approved the robbing of caravans. So they would not only would they conquer people around and loot them, they'd start robbing all the caravans that came through, especially the caravans that came from Mecca. They weren't supposed to do it, though, during the holy weeks, and in particular the holy month of Ramadan. Yet eventually jihad, which the word means struggle or to strive. And it can be a war, it can be a physical struggle, or it can be a spiritual struggle with God. It means to struggle towards a praiseworthy aim, to struggle against evil inclinations. It then also came to mean to forcefully convert unbelievers for the sake of Islam. And he decided that it was allowed even in the holy month of Ramadan if Islam was being threatened and if there were threats to what was known as the Ummah. U-M-M-A means the brotherhood of all Muslims. Sunni Muslims, Shiites or not, but Sunni Muslims, even today, look for the Imam in a Sunni mosque doesn't have the powers to lead in prayer and to lead in serving other people. In the Shia, the Imams and the Ayatollahs wield power and strength with an iron fist. But the Sunni Muslims, of which 90% of Muslims are Sunni, want the worldwide brotherhood of Muslims as well. It's by consensus and other things, not by an Ayatollah or an Imam who then wields the sword. So the Ummah is the brotherhood of all Muslims. It's the worldwide idea. And so it was okay to defend Islam from threats. It was okay to fight in the name of Allah, to defend the Ummah, and to right wrongs done against you by other people who were in opposition. In Surah, which is chapter, by the way, the Quran is not in any particular order except from the longest book to the shortest, except for the very first one, which is a prayer. And there are some things, we'll talk later, they have something called abrogation. If Muhammad was given a recitation while he was in Mecca, and then later, while he was in Medina, he got a different recitation that refuted the first one, they call it abrogation. Then the first recitation is done away with, and the later recitation is the one that you do.
So I wasn't given the right one to start with. What?
What they would argue is that the earlier one was meant for that particular point in time, and later things changed, and so that was meant for later. Yeah. For example, for when he said, you know, it's okay in the sacred month, in Surah 2:216 and 2:17. Fighting is obligatory for you, much as you dislike it. But you may hate a thing, although it is good for you, and love a thing, although it is bad for you. God knows, but you do not. They ask you about the sacred month. Say, to fight in this month is a grave offense. but to debar others from the path of God, to deny him and to expel his worshipers from the holy mosque, is far more grave in his sight. Idolatry is more grievous than bloodshed, therefore it is okay. So, in order to overcome idolatry, if it means going in and wiping out somebody because idolatry is a threat to Islam, then it's okay, even in the sacred month. The Quraysh, the big tribe from which he came, didn't particularly like all of that. And so they fought against him near the Red Sea, but he won the battle with his army. And so a lot more Bedouins started following him. Later on, though, as battles go, he went up against the Quraysh again, and they outnumbered him, and his archers left their post. They got scared and left their post, and so he lost, which only infuriated him even more. Now, early on in Medina, Jews were impressed with Muhammad. I mean, he came talking about monotheism and unity, and the Jews in Syria, some of them had migrated to Medina, the Jews in Syria, along with the Christians, were living in peace and monotheism and unity. And so early on, the Jews in Medina were impressed with that message of monotheism, and they started supporting his efforts. However, they parted company after a time because Muhammad believed he was proclaiming a restored Judaism and a reformed Christianity. What he taught and what he said he was taught was, for example, Moses came and Moses gave the law, and that was good for a while. Moses was a prophet of Allah. But after a while, the people began to use the law for various aberrations of the law. They didn't follow it properly. So the next prophet, David, comes along to correct that. Joshua comes along to correct it. Then David comes along to correct it. And so the one who comes later always comes to correct a misunderstanding of the previous one's teachings. And so that created some issue with them about him doing that. But he then said that he was God's final prophet. There would be no other. He had the ultimate correction for everyone, and that was this new religion. And in 626, the Jews in Medina said, no, you don't have the ultimate revelation. You're not the final one. In fact, they believed that God still used prophets and would continue to do so. So Muhammad then got mad, accused them of ridiculing his belief that he was God's final prophet. They didn't side with him when he went out for a battle. He made some changes. Used to, up until that point, because what city did Gabriel take him to see before he took him through the seven heavens? Jerusalem. Up until that point in time, when a follower of Islam prayed, they turned and faced Jerusalem and prayed. Well, now, because the Jews didn't side with him, he said, well, it's Mecca, where the Kaaba is. It's not Jerusalem, it's Mecca. Jerusalem's still an important city, but Mecca was now the city. So he changed prayer facing Mecca. He declared before that, the holy month in Islam was not Ramadan. It coincided with Ashura, which was a Jewish month, holy month. So he changed it from Ashura to Ramadan. So see, abrogation already. Well, my later revelation, because you didn't stick up for me, is that we're going to face Mecca instead of Jerusalem. We're going to have Ramadan instead of Ashura. He then banished, there were three Jewish tribes in the area. He banished two of them, charged the third one with conspiracy against them, and then in what became also typical for those within Arabia who won battles, he had all of their men brought out in front of their families and slaughtered. And then he sold all the women and children into slavery. So he's gone from peace and unity and monotheism to a radical monotheism where there's no room for any other ideas. And if you don't like me and don't think I'm the final prophet, then we'll have you killed and sell off your women and children. Even though Quran in Surah 2, verse 256, says the following about religion. There shall be no compulsion in religion. True guidance is now distinct from error. He that renounces idol worship and puts his faith in God shall grasp a firm handle that will never break, for God hears all and knows all. In other words, and there's several other places where Quran says you're not to force religion on people. Suddenly he started forcing it. And even though Quran in several places states not only is there no compulsion in religion, but you are to live at peace with the people of the book if they will live under your rule. He did that. A Quranic scholar by the name of Tor Andre writes, and I quote, "One must see Muhammad's cruelty toward the Jews against the backdrop of the fact that their scorn and rejection for him was the greatest disappointment of his life. And for a time, they, that is, and what they did, threatened completely to destroy his prophetic authority." End of quote. In other words, this might cause people to think I'm not really that final prophet, so na-na-na-na-boo-boo, I'm going to have you killed and sold off, you know, to prove that I'm that final authority. So, in 630 A.D., he led 10,000 warriors to Mecca, and people had heard about all of his other stuff, and they saw 10,000 soldiers, and they didn't put up a fight. They surrendered completely. He went to the Kaaba. Muhammad went inside and destroyed all the idols and all the idols that were outside of it. He dedicated it to Allah only, and then claimed that this site was sacred because it was where God gave Hagar and Ishmael water to drink from a spring. You may remember the story in Genesis where Sarah runs them out. Well, they were about to die. And then later Abraham runs them out. They were about to die without water. And Allah showed up and gave them water from a spring. Then he went on to claim that the Kaaba was actually built or rebuilt. It had been there as a smaller structure. It was actually rebuilt by Ishmael and Abraham, who came to visit Ishmael and apologize for all kinds of things and all, and built it right there. So that's the Kaaba is supposedly where this took place, and all of these kinds of things. And so this was the place to worship the one true God. Muhammad saw the world is divided into two camps. I'm going to give you a little more description than I, back in the 70s, I was at a meeting, a guy stood up, it was a religious meeting, stood up and he got ready to speak and he said, "I divide the world into two groups of people. You know who you are." And then he started his speech. I said, what? But Muhammad saw the world as two camps. And by the way, this does underpin a lot of what we find in Islam even today. There are two camps in the world, the house of Islam and the house of war. He believed he was to bring all of the non-Islamic world to submission to Allah and into the house of Islam. If not, then they're in the house of war and they are fair game. If they refuse. He sent word at that time to Persia, to the Persia and the Byzantine empires, calling on them to the new faith, to come to the new faith. In fact, he wrote a letter or a note to Heraclius of Constantinople, which read as follows. "Now then, I invite you to Islam. Embrace Islam and you will be safe. Embrace Islam and Allah will bestow on you a double reward. But if you reject this invitation of Islam, you shall be responsible for misguiding the peasants." End of quote. In other words, I'm giving you an invitation. If you come, you're going to be okay. If you don't, all bets are off. Neither empire accepted the invitation, by the way. And eventually, they used Surah 9:29, this recitation, for as their their mantra for conquering. Fight against such of those to whom the scriptures were given as believe in neither God nor the last day, who do not forbid what God and his apostles have forbidden and do not embrace the true faith until they pay tribute out of their hands or are utterly subdued. That was given while he was in Medina. If you went by, if they were listed chronologically, chapter 96 that I read a while ago would be first, because that was the first recitation. Chapter 5 would be the last recitation. And just before chapter 5 would be chapter 9. But it's not arranged in any, it's just arranged as they get from longest to shortest. Longest to shortest. And that was the strategy to fight until you convert, accept living under rule and the jizya, which was a very expensive tax, or you die. Jews and Christians who paid the jizya were called dhimmis. That's not like Demi Moore. That's D-H-I-M-M-I-S, dhimmis, which were second-class citizens. They had no rights. But they were, the dhimmi, it means protected and yet guilty. The guilty means you received revelations from Allah, but you perverted them or forgot them and rejected Muhammad as the final prophet. But since you're people of the book, you can pay the jizya and stay and be second-class citizens. Or you can die. Or you can convert. Muhammad died in 632 and left no male children. He got married after his first wife. He got married to other wives, and he left no male heirs. He only had daughters. And so he did not name a successor. So, Islam then was born out of an ethos of paganism and violence. It began as a peaceful and unifying move, but then moved back to that idea of violence. And the disagreement over who would succeed Muhammad only added to that, because he did not name a successor. According to the traditions, there are three basic traditions about his successor. First, he didn't name one. Period. So people started scrambling to see who would succeed him. Secondly, the second tradition is that he privately named his close confidant Abu Bakr. And Aisha, his youngest and favorite wife after his first wife died, liked Abu Bakr, and she said that Muhammad did indeed name him as successor. Of course, that's kind of like the deal with in the Bible where Bathsheba and Nathan the prophet go to David and say, you know, long, long time ago, don't you remember that you said you wanted Solomon to be your successor? The third tradition is that his cousin and son-in-law by blood should have become the next one, Ali ibn Abi Talib. And by the way, the Shiites, the Shia, are actually followers of the Shiatu Ali is what they were initially called. That's the party of Ali. He didn't float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. In fact, he wasn't that successful a leader. But Shia, S-H-I apostrophe A, Shia, or Shiites, S-H-I apostrophe I-T-E-S, was the shortened version of Shiatu Ali. So, Abu Bakr becomes the initial leader. I know y'all got all this. It'll be a test at the no. Just to kind of get, but what I, yeah, but what I really wanted to do tonight was kind of give a little more than I normally do in world religions about Islam, the founding of it, just to give you an understanding of where it comes from and why. I mean, it started out, you know, peaceful. It's a peaceful religion, everybody says. Well, some are peaceful and some are not. Started out peaceful, but then devolved into violence.
Peaceful because there were, what, but two or three of them. What are you going to do with that? But then when you get into 10,000s and things like this, then you're going to become warlike when you get the odds in your favor and that sort of thing.
Well, the leader was the rightly guided caliph. And Abu Bakr was the first one, and he continued the expansion of Islam, trying to bring together the Ummah, the universal brotherhood.
We wouldn't have a problem with when we said, yeah, you'd like to talk about what the Christians believed in, not right. In other words, he's still been a peaceful guy.
If everybody had submitted and said, yeah, he was the last prophet in Judaism and Christianity, it would have been peaceful for them.
Yeah.
But his folks, even his own family, said, no, you're not. And so he's, you know. We know, I said, no, we know you.
That's
when he's still peaceful. Yeah. And so there was no reversion. There were a lot, the tribes, after he died, the tribes said, well, okay, Abu Bakr, you can be the, you know, I'm thinking Abu, and I'm thinking about the, that's the monkey's name in. But, in Aladdin, in the movie Aladdin. But, you can be the head, but, each of the tribes now, we need to go back to having our own leader. And he's, no. Muhammad had gone away from that, unified you all. He refused. In fact, those who continued to try and push that, he actually had killed. So their tribes would join up. Well, they split over all kinds of things. The Shia and the Sunnis. And the Sufis are the mystics, and they're just, they don't get involved in all that other stuff. But so he formed a worldwide mindset for Islam. He focused on unifying the tribes and weeding out apostasy, not only apostasy from a theological standpoint, being apostate against God, but apostasy from a governmental standpoint. If you're against him, then you're an apostate and you deserve to die. So he wielded the sword and expanded. The second caliph was Umar ibn al-Khattab, who was a close friend of Muhammad and Bakr. He was also one of Muhammad's sons-in-law. Remember, Muhammad had daughters. So he was a son-in-law. And he continued. It's under him that Islam conquered Iraq, Syria, Egypt, and most of the Persian and Byzantine empires. And then what he would do, he added a new twist. Instead of having tribal leaders, he created satellite garrisons and outposts in every land that they conquered, in major towns, so that cuts down. I mean, if you got the soldiers marching around, you got the stormtroopers there, that cuts down on people rebelling. And he also approved plundering all lands that were conquered to fill the coffers. Under him, most Christians in those areas agreed to be dhimmis and pay the jizya rather than die. The third was Uthman ibn Affan, who expanded the empire. He took over Cyprus, major parts of North Africa, Armenia, the Caucasus, Afghanistan, and much of India. So once again, this whole thing of continuing to move and conquer the world, it's not just now, it's been going on since this began. He got rid of some of the earlier leaders that were appointed by other caliphs, which caused him in 656 to be assassinated. At that point, finally, Ali ibn Abi Talib, Ali, the cousin and son-in-law of Muhammad, who said all along, I'm a blood relative and I ought to be the next one. Because of his well-placed supporters, he took over and became, and the party of Ali, as I said, Shi'atu Ali, became later shortened to Shia, or the Shiites. But he wasn't very successful because all of a sudden, you know what he did? He said, well, you know, all you folks before that didn't like me or didn't want me to be here and all. Well, Muhammad initially started preaching peace and unity, so I'm going to forgive you. What did his followers, his followers, his supporters, didn't want forgiveness. They wanted revenge. And so he, in fact, he even ends up giving reconciliation to those who assassinated his predecessor. Although he did take away all of his predecessor's relatives out of important positions. Many Muslims rebelled. Aisha gathered troops to fight Ali at what was known as the Battle of the Camel. That was the first of many civil wars. Ali won. But then he turned around and pardoned Aisha and all of her followers that didn't get killed, and that created more disgust among his followers for him. Yeah. And so it caused a split in his coalition, and the Kharijite faction of extremists who thought the caliph was to be Allah's spokesman rebelled against him. And even though Ali defeated their army, later he was in a mosque praying, and a Kharijite didn't even turn out to be a suicide mission. Ran in, screaming in the name of Allah, and killed him right there in the mosque. So, civil war. And by the way, the Shia, and we'll talk about this the next time we gather, but the Shia and the Sunnis, the Shia are in the minority, the Sunnis are the majority, but they have been fighting ever since the 7th century between themselves. And then that gets extended out into the world at large. You know, with all the Christians and Jews and others who have been killed over the millennia, there have been more Muslims killed by Muslims than Christians and Jews killed, because they've been fighting each other for over 1,300 years. Right. Well, the Sunnis are in control of some parts, and the Shia are in control of others. And and Saddam Hussein was a Sunni.
But they were in the minority in terms of the number. So the minority was controlling the majority.
Yes.
So why in the world do Americans think that we could go over there and establish a government?
Because we've been the world's policemen for so long. Well, and that's true. It's not a government that they would want. What's really interesting is, though they're in the minority in some places, the Shiites are in the vast majority in Iran and for most of Iraq.
And they're the most religious, strongest, aren't they?
They are typically the most ultra-conservative. Although there are some within the Sunni faction that are very conservative, but it's not so much the violence thing, but the Shiites are extremely, extremely conservative religiously as well as politically, and you know, they want to bring about, in fact, some Shia, there are some texts that teach that, and we'll talk the next time we talk about this, there's some texts that teach that the final imam, there's a group known as the Twelvers, and there's supposed to be 12 imams. The final imam, his return and the end of the world and paradise and all, judgment and all this kind of stuff can be hastened if certain threats to Islam can be established, so that then he'll come back and close it out early. Kind of like, some of what they try to do is to put Islam in, or to at least make it look like Islam is in such dire straits that maybe they can get Al-Mahdi to come back. That's what he's called, Al-Mahdi, the chosen one. Get him to come back sooner, because the 12th imam was 4 years old when his dad died, and so he couldn't be, and he disappeared mysteriously, and so most Shia believe that he never died, the spirit of Allah has camouflaged him, and he's somewhere in the world now. And one day he'll show up, and they can help do that. But then again, you got people like John Hagee who wants to bring about Armageddon.
We side with the Shah of Iran.
We did side with the Shah of Iran at that time, and the Ayatollah Khomeini came in, and he was the Ayatollahs in Shiite tradition. Ayatollahs wield the imams wield power, and the Ayatollahs are imam-like over larger areas sometimes, and they wield power with an iron fist. Right. Yes. They do. That, I mean, that's how they treat them, and very, very strictly.
There's a large group of young people, though, if they're not coming along in Iran, that do not follow the belief about women. They're not as strict
right.
in wearing the
parka. Right, and yeah.
And they can get jobs.
The hijab.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are moves, and that's more Sunni than it is Shia, some of the younger ones. But it is, but they are in the minority in Iran. The Sunnis are. But that is something that goes on. And in most of the Islamic, major Islamic countries, marriages are still arranged, but in that group, they're starting to God. Another thing that which the Ayatollah Khomeini brought back, which had actually been prior to him coming back in, had been declared, even though Muhammad had said you could do this in a hadith, multiple wives and all this kind of stuff, but he also said you could have temporary marriages. The Shah of Iran, that had been done away with when the Shah of Iran was gotten rid of and Ayatollah Khomeini came in. Not only have women killed who wouldn't go back to the traditional garb, but then he declared that temporary marriage was something that could be done. Ongoing marriage or general marriage is for no specified period of time.
Yeah.
Temporary marriage is a marriage of convenience or marriage for pleasure, and it lasts anywhere from an hour to another. But you have to state how long it's going to last. But it starts at an hour that you're married. That is, you're the possession of that man, and then goes on. It can be a month, a day, a month, a year. 5 years, but then it ends. Whereas the traditional marriage does not have a time limit placed on it. The temporary marriage does, and a temporary marriage is simply called marriage of convenience or marriage for pleasure.
It was kind of split there, wasn't it? The Shah, he was per se a president, and Ayatollah come from more from the parliament side. Congress per se took over.
Well, and the Ayatollah had been exiled. That's one of the things. Sometimes they come back. Yeah. And a lot of the reason in even more ancient times that, I mean, Solomon, Adonijah is making plans to be king, and Solomon and Bathsheba knew exactly what would happen if Adonijah became king. He'd kill he'd kill any pretenders to the throne, which would include Solomon, and he'd kill Bathsheba. So then Solomon's declared king, Solomon becomes king, Adonijah has one possible ace in his pocket, and he goes to Bathsheba, not Solomon, and he wants Abishag. I sure hope she looked better in her name. He wants Abishag, who was was the latest concubine and the favored concubine, a beautiful woman, a Shunammite, that he wanted. Well, I ought to get something out of it. Just give me Abishag. Well, see, if you thought that you were, or you claimed that you were wrongly denied becoming the next king, if you could get the favored concubine, then that was seen in society as proof that you should be the king and all this. But Bathsheba didn't buy it. She went and told Solomon. So what Solomon had? Solomon didn't exile him. Solomon had him killed. Because, he could come back. Yeah. And so the Ayatollah came back and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
I frankly, when I think most historians would look at that book today, it would not have very much credibility.
Right.
But one of the things that I remember from that was the term holy war. Mm. And you associated the term holy war right. with Islam. Or as I
well.
Mohammedanism.
Right, and they were called Mohammedans. In fact, in the beginning of this country, when Roger Williams sets up the first Baptist congregation in Providence, Rhode Island, and later all the papers are drawn up for that colony, he uses, be they're free to worship, be they Baptist, Methodist, Turks, Mohammedans, Jews, you know, or infidels. And when William Penn, actually Pennsylvania, was that way, when William Penn did, he used the term Mohammedans mm-hmm. in there. Iran is Persia. That whole area was a part of the Persian Empire. Iran and Iraq. Okay. Well, thank y'all. We won't be back next Sunday night. Dr. Vinny will be here, but the following Sunday night we'll pick this up and talk about Shia and Sunni and Quran and some other things, if that's okay with y'all. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.